Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Spotlight for Justice, Episode 2. My name is Michelle Bart, and with me is Dr. Kathy Mathis, our co-host. And Dr. Mathis and I agree with Dr. Paul Farmer's quote, "The idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong in the world." Nothing is more true than a case that we have been on for the last couple weeks in trial with the Warren Forest murder trial. This is part one, which will be a series of shows with expert witnesses, survivors, victims of this monster, and others that can now speak out. He is it is scheduled for sentencing on February 17th at 11:30 a.m. at Clark County Superior Court. But today we're going to have a voice for the voiceless, victims that have yet to be found, victims we believe were his victims. We have our client, Star Laura, the sister of Jamie Grissom, with us today. And we also will be speaking to a survivor that was able to tell her story 50 years later in order to get this man prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law for an other first-degree murder case. I am, without further ado, I am going to bring on Dr. Kathy Mathis, my co-host of Spotlight for Justice. We have Star Laura from Texas, who is here until through sentencing to see that this man gets put away again for a second life sentence. And we also have one of two of his survivors, Norma Countryman Lewis. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start with Dr. Mathis. Before we dive into the case, knowing the case that we've talked about and we've been in court for the last couple weeks on, this is a case that took 50 years to get to where we're at today. Even though he is serving a life sentence without he had the possibility of parole, now that he has been prosecuted for a second time on first-degree murder, tell us a little bit about understanding the mind of this predator that in his 20s, it's thought prior to 1974, maybe even earlier than 1971 when Jamie went missing from Fort Vancouver High School. Help us get in this guy's psyche. He's 73 now.
I don't know if we want to get into his psyche, Michelle. But I can give you a little bit about the predator and you know, and not making this real long, but to give you sort of an overview. First of all, research shows that most predators become a predator and decide to become a predator between the age of 3 and 6 years of age. So something is broken. They have what's called a lack of coherent personality. They also, some of them are genetically predisposed to being a psychopath. A sociopath is usually raised by another sociopath, and a psychopath is born genetically. They have a gene, according to Dr. Fallon, who's done all the research on psychopathy. And what happens with these individuals is because they are doing things that most of us would not do, they start off by building up a tolerance. So they're going to break any empathy that they have, which is connectedness, to them, to other people, they're going to do things to try to break that empathy. So they will start off, a lot of them, by killing animals. They'll move up from killing animals to killing human beings and things like that. So one of the terms that is used in describing a psychopath is they are soulless, because empathy connects you to your soul. And because they are choosing to go along what I call the dark path instead of choosing to get help and go on the path of decency and light and truth and that kind of thing, they will begin to grow up learning what normal behaviors are. They will watch and mimic what normal behaviors are so that people don't identify them. That's one of the things that they will do besides trying to break the lack of empathy. So they are walking around mimicking normality, looking normal, so people don't identify them. So great chameleons. So they will fit in because they're able to mimic and be like a chameleon extremely well in their community. I mean, a lot of them get married and their significant others don't even know that they are what they are. Also, they are masterful at manipulation and lying so that they can, you know, I always say they can sell you the horse fly off of a horse's rear end, and you would buy it thinking it's the best horse fly you've ever been told about. So they are fabulous at doing that kind of thing. But the thing that I think is really important for people to understand about a predator is they pick and choose their victims. Sometimes it's, you know, it's rare, but sometimes it's opportunity right on the spot. But most of the time they will pick and choose their victim. Also, once they have done that act of evil, they are not satisfied. They are never, ever satisfied, which is why they become serial murderers and mass murderers. They keep going on and on and on. So for those of us who are looking at this individual, and especially for people who actually know this predator, who might be friends or former friends of this predator, you'll hear them on TV. They'll all go, well, I never saw that. I never knew that. It's hard for me to believe that this person is who they are. Well, that's because you've been highly manipulated by this person. You've been.
So,
Go ahead. Okay. So you have been a part of them proving to themselves how smart they are, that they could outsmart everybody around them so that they wouldn't know who they are. So they pride themselves in being smarter than everybody else. Their egos are I'm the smartest person in the room, so to speak. And
we saw that in the courtroom too.
Exactly. And they don't fully understand the magnitude of what their murderous behaviors have on other people, because they are only empathetic towards themselves. So even when they get caught, you'll see some of them crying. Well, they're not crying because they murdered somebody or they did something they shouldn't. They're crying because they got caught.
So with that, and I want to bring on Norma, who instead of starting in 1971 with STAR, let's start with you, Norma, in 1974, where he did get caught. You were 15 at the time. And take us back, if you will, whatever your comfort level is with it, but take us back to how you weren't listened to and how many lives could have been saved because no one listened to you.
I think to start off with, we have to understand that in the 70s, perceptions of young girls were a lot different than they are today. Young girls who got caught up like I did, we were just juvenile delinquents or runaways or I'm not sure exactly what the term is or how to describe it, but it's easier to discount what a young person, especially a female person, is saying and just brush it off as, oh, she just didn't want to get in trouble, so she made it up. And that's what happened to me. Understand, I was pretty beat up. Any sane person, I feel, any person in their right mind would look at me and not think I made it up. And yet that is exactly what I was confronted with after spending all night in the woods, terrorized, exhausted, worried about my mother, what she would, how she would feel. When I was found, the gentleman who found me was very empathetic, very sympathetic as well, very caring. He didn't hesitate. He called the police. He knew something was wrong. The police got there and I guess didn't account for the fact that I was in shock and told me right to my face, you're too calm. I don't believe you. You're just too calm. You're not acting hysterical like somebody who had this happen to them. Told me to my face, and 48 years later, I remember his exact words. I think you stayed out with friends too long. I think you missed your curfew, and you or one of your friends came up with this wild idea to pull this stunt and then make an anonymous phone call to the police so that you wouldn't get in trouble with your parents. 18 years old. I didn't want to tell him I didn't really have friends, so that wasn't happening. But at that point, I just shut down. I quit trying to explain what happened to me. I quit trying to make him believe me. I knew that there was nothing that I could say to him that would make him believe me.
And we still have that issue 50 years later, especially when teens go missing. And hopefully we'll be able to continue to bring that to the forefront, because I think every second is a mile when somebody, a child, a teen, goes missing. And, you know, here we have as many, we know of 7 victims and 2 survivors. We know that it's stated in record in the court that it could have been as much as 16 to 18 victims. That's a lot of family members who have died before they could see justice. That's a lot of family members that are still living with not knowing what happened to their child. Exactly. You mentioned to somebody this week, to one of the reporters, about how guilty you feel that you weren't able to save some of the other victims. That's heavy.
Yes. I feel, ever since the first time when he was brought to trial for murdering another victim, I have always felt that. But it came home to me harder this year, this month, with this trial, because I learned things now in 2023 that were not made known to me in 1979. I do know that the fact that I couldn't make him believe me is what led to the death, we suspect, well, we know now one of them, of 2 more women and the brutalization of a third. And I don't care what anybody says to me, how it wasn't my fault. I understand that. I put that directly on the police officer, directly on that police officer. I understand it wasn't my fault, and yet I still feel that guilt and horror that if only I could make him believe me, we could have stopped it with me.
And for
I'll
the record,
that's my grave.
That's very heavy. And for the record, that officer, which we won't name, but that officer was a witness in this murder trial. And did he not apologize to you in the lobby of the courtroom?
I'm not sure I want to address that. I haven't come to terms with it yet.
I understand completely. I want to bring on Star. Star Lara is the sister of Jamie Grissom. Jamie attended Fort Vancouver High School. She went missing in 1971 and has not been heard from since. And it's the thought of not only Jamie's family, but also those that have done a lot on this case, whether it's the medical examiner's office to detectives, et cetera. It's also their belief that Jamie was one of his first victims, if not one of the earlier victims. Star, welcome to Spotlight for Justice.
Thank you.
So, Star, how do you feel about the verdict this past week?
Well, I'm very happy about it because I wanted him to go down as a serial killer, that he is, and he would always come up for parole every 3 years since 2011, 2014, 2017, and 2021. And the very last one, he talked about how he visits on the phone with his grandsons and his daughter and how he will go live with them when he gets out. All that stuff, listening to that and how he says he's a different man and all that, and he only killed one was his thing. That's very hard on the families, and that's what makes me so happy that he will never put any of us through that again. And now he's lost all hope. He's given us hope that we will never have to listen to him again. And he has no hope of ever getting out.
So my understanding is on sentencing, no matter if he gets 36 to life, he's 73 years old. He's frail. Obviously,
right.
We sat with him for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what his sentence is it my understanding that he will never get parole again? Norma, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
So is that... is that correct? So no matter what his sentence could be, whether it's 10 to life, 36 to life, what have you, this conviction has now prevented him from ever being able to re-victimize any of you again from having to testify in a parole hearing.
Well, I believe that's true for the simple reason that my understanding is that he will be sentenced under the guidelines of murder in the first degree from 1974, because that is when the murder happened. That's when the charge happened, which means in 1979, basically, it was 39 years to life. He was eligible to apply for parole after 39 years. So I'm thinking that that's probably going to be right in the same range. So let's say that in 39 years, he's eligible for parole and he applies. That's saying that he's now lived to 112 years old or somewhere like that. So in my eyes, in my heart, I'm believing that we're done with him. We're done with him, except for what we need and want from him. But having to go sit through that painful, like Star said, very painful event every 3 or 4 years of having to relive it again in front of, even though they're sympathetic people, even though they're very understanding and hearing our story and knowing our pain, it's still very hard to do. We won't have to do
it. It's re-victimizing.
Exactly.
And we discussed this in our first show where it's horrible with the fact that the justice system has to re-victimize the victims and their loved ones in order to possibly see justice. But in the meantime, the due process is always on the perpetrator and not the victim. And we need to change that in society.
Yes.
We definitely need to change that. Star, are you back with us? Okay, I'm not sure what happened with Star. But let me bring on Dr. Mathis again. Dr. Mathis, I have Norma on the line with us. Norma is the survivor of this horrible monster. But as she stated, we're not going to have to go through every 3 years of a parole hearing. What does that do to the victimization of victims, survivors, and loved ones when you got to keep doing that in order to prove your case so the individual is not let out?
Well, there's a couple things that come to mind in that kind of circumstance, and that is, first of all, why are we even giving these individuals the opportunity for parole? That should never mm-hmm. be given to begin with. So that needs to be changed. Anybody that has taken the life of somebody else, I heard Norma say that in court he said he was a changed man. Well, yes, he is. He's older. That's it. There's nothing else that's changed with this person. And so when they come up for a parole hearing, the family of the loved ones that are no longer with us have to go back in and relive that experience over and over and over with each parole hearing that's there if they decide to show up. Some of them can't even show up because they're being re-victimized and re-traumatized by having to relive this just so the justice system can say, oh, well, this person gets parole. They deserve parole. Why? What have they done that deserves parole? At the expense of the loved ones of the murdered victims having to show up and say, no, we're here to represent our loved one. They don't get out on parole. Because I'm going to tell you, research shows that these individuals do not change. So when he says,
and you know,
he's
you
changed,
and I want to piggyback on that in regards to changing. Star, are you back with us? Star, are you there? Not sure what's happening with Star, but I've got Norma here, and I want to piggyback on that because the chilling thing, well, all of it was chilling for me for 2 weeks, especially listening to the two survivors, because that gave you an insight to his madness. Where the other victims couldn't participate. But Norma, listening to the audio tapes, had you heard all of those audio tapes and that psychologist before?
Absolutely not. I tried to. Once my daughter told me that I would be able to get a copy of all of his parole board meetings and what he said, I kept trying to make myself order one of those, and I just couldn't do it. The only time I've ever heard his voice is the little tiny bit that he speaks in court and then on that audio tape that they played in court last week. It's the only time I've heard any of it. I just can't make myself listen to him.
And I want to interject there, Big Norma. What you have gone through, there's no reason for you to need to hear all of this stuff. You were there. You were a survivor of his. And for you to be put in the position of a parole hearing and having to be in the presence of somebody who did what they did to you every so often is unconscionable. It is, you know, you made this statement earlier when you were talking with Michelle about people, you know, understanding, you know, kind of thing. People don't understand. People don't get what it's like to be a survivor of somebody who's trying to kill you. That is something you cannot describe to people, the terror experience, and then having to relive it by going to a court case, by going to parole hearings, whatever. That is trauma on top of trauma, victimization on top of victimization, all in the name of we're doing justice for the perpetrator. The perpetrator doesn't deserve the justice. The victim.
I think we have a
can
Star.
Can anybody hear me?
Star, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Had you? We're talking about the audio tapes that were presented in court. Had you heard those during parole hearings before?
I believe so. I don't know if I heard all of Daria's before.
Daria's account of what happened with her?
Right. I've heard Norma's before, yes.
But the audio
tapes
of everything that was so chilling to me for 2 weeks, and then when the jury asked to hear the audio tapes again, audio tapes were for Dr. Mathis, to give you an idea, these audio tapes were done for a parole hearing. And his psychiatrist that was present at the time, along with his attorney, in this parole hearing, they flew him out from Maine or Vermont or something, and he took the stand. It was chilling to hear that this monster did not seem like anything was wrong. He told the story of Doria and Norma, two survivors, what he did. He also said he didn't, and this was his justification, he didn't intend to murder Martha, but it just happened, you know, or Krista Blake.
No, wait, I beg to differ with you. He's never said one word about Martha except he pled not guilty. What he said was
that
he killed Krista accidentally. He didn't mean to. And that gets back to what the doctor said about them not taking responsibility. It was Krista's fault that she's dead because Krista fought back.
That's correct. I stand corrected. You're right. But those audio tapes were pretty chilling because he was depicting, he was telling the story of all of these cases in hopes to get a reduced sentence or get out on parole or whatever he was doing at these parole hearings, but you did not hear of a man that felt guilty. And
but that's what I was talking about earlier when I said, they lack empathy for everybody except for themselves, and they don't have a coherent personality like normal people do. And blaming the person that they murdered is very common. Well, it was their fault. They shouldn't have fought me.
Yeah.
I didn't plan on it. Well, then if you didn't plan on it, where was your self-control? Because you don't go around murdering everybody you encounter, so therefore you have some self-control. So of the baloney that flies around and comes out of these people's mouths, if their lips are moving, they're lying. That's my philosophy.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yep.
Star, I know that we lost connection there. Tell us about Jamie.
Jamie was very smart. She skipped a year in school. That's why she was going to graduate a year early. And she was very artistic. She drew beautiful illustrations and drawings, and she had won a small scholarship of $500 for art school. She had beautiful cursive handwriting. A classmate of hers told me during the trial time that she knew her for 3 months until she disappeared, and she was sweet, and she was funny, and she was cute. That's what she told me, which is all true, you know. And I've been told by many people that she was funny. And I remembered it more at the time, and my humor that's developed over time, it's actually her humor in a way. I can feel it, you know. But she was very caring. She was probably very unselfish. I think I was more selfish than she was at the time. Like, for instance,
but Jamie hasn't been found, correct?
No.
Okay. What makes you think Warren Forrest had anything to do with her disappearance?
I didn't think so. The police told me so because of where she was found. And the day they told me, in 1976, I found out about Martha, who hadn't been identified. That's when they came to me for dental records. And they told me about Martha and the other girl. I knew that day she would never come back alive. I still hoped. I still prayed. I still asked people about her. And, you know, passed out pictures and information about her. But I knew she was never coming back alive. She never would have been out on Dole Valley Road, which was very remote then, even still remote today, in the dead of winter. She wouldn't have been out there. And her
items were discovered in an area that he frequent with his victims,
right.
Correct?
Just up the road from where those girls' bodies were found. And if you go out there and see just how remote it is, it's chilling. And I've been told by a police detective, actually one that testified in the trial, I was told in 1988, the reason Jamie, has never been found was that she was buried near the entrance of Sunset Falls Campground, and it's been paved over. He told me in 1988 he would never be found, and it's proven true. And that is a really hard thing to deal with, because people say, well, she's never been found, therefore she must be alive. She's not alive. And if you feel that person's spirit around you, you know she's not alive.
And the media
efforts
that you've continued over the years, it's for information leading to answers of what happened to your sister.
Right, exactly.
Do you think you'll ever get that from this monster?
Not unless there was something in it for him. If there was, I am going to he was getting porn, okay? He was getting porn delivered. Prosecutor asked
There's something wrong with that.
Very, very wrong. A sexual predator, a serial sexual predator, a serial rapist, and a serial killer getting porn delivered to his prison. And the prosecutor at the time told me, please don't say anything about it because we're going to charge him eventually. And this is one of our bargaining chips, and they have few. Okay, I was told by the lead prosecutor recently that they contacted the Department of Corrections, and they said he's been a model prisoner, never any infractions in 48 years?
Three.
I think that's what they told me. And they weren't going to take away any privileges. And I told them, everybody in the media knows that he is getting porn, but I will verify it with some people that are able to give me that information.
And how,
you know,
does
I
want to
make sure.
How does that make you feel, and you too, Norma, that not only have you both been victimized by this horrible monster, but that your tax dollars allow that kind of crap from happening behind bars with a serial rapist?
Yeah.
You mean besides outraged?
Outraged, yeah. That, I think nothing else made me as angry as hearing that he was getting porn.
The thing is,
well, I heard from a reporter this week that he also was allowed to have his wife come in and they could have sex. So for a reporter to tell us that this week, that was like, are you serious? Why is that being allowed?
Yeah. I know.
So again,
a sexual predator.
The justice system is not really there to bring justice. It's just to house somebody on our tax dollars and allow him to do the same stuff that he's been doing to others. Now you can welcome people in to do it and read porn magazines. There's something wrong with that. Kathy, what do you make of that?
Well, again, Department of Corrections are supposed to rehabilitate people. That's their job. Obviously, they're not doing that great of a job when they are sending porn into a serial sexual murder. Obviously, when they are allowing visitation with his wife to have, conjugal visits, et cetera. What has that got to do with rehabilitation? I have worked in almost every prison in California over the years, and one of the things that I do know is usually sexual predators in prison mind their P's and Q's, so to speak, because they're not liked in prison, and especially when they have murdered a child. So for the fact that he's behaving himself, it's only because if he doesn't, he's got consequences inside of prison by the other inmates that he does not want to have. So this, again, I go back to my point of he hasn't changed any. But these individuals can manipulate, can be like chameleons and behave themselves when the consequences are so great for themselves that it requires them to do so.
Yeah. And that's
so
just it.
Pardon me?
Even though he's in prison, he's incarcerated, really, what hardship is he suffering? What consequences is he... I just don't get it.
Right.
He's,
I don't
that's right. That's,
apparently
that's
the best
to life
that he
point.
Can in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah,
to
he's
my
getting
point,
food and shelter and well, medical
we're paying
care.
For that. All
yeah,
of us
exactly.
are paying for that to happen. And
he
so
has,
why do we have to pay for a serial murder? Why do we have to pay for anybody that's incarcerated in our country? Because we didn't do anything wrong. But we have to support and pay and give them rights because they...
Yeah.
decided not to follow the laws of our land, that makes
they took
no
right of
sense.
Other people.
Right.
Yeah.
And remember this, though. 50 years of all of these cases and all of this investigation, two prosecutions, you know, all the – because he's indigent, I guess. He has court-appointed attorney, all of that is taxpayer dollars. And then we finally get justice on not one but two murders of Krista Blake and Martha Morrison, and then you hear this garbage that what he's getting in corrections, and it's like, are you serious? Where is the justice?
He just goes back to his comfy existence, such as it is. But seriously, I mean, he's getting good medical care. He's getting everything that he needs. He might not be getting all of the comforts of the outside world, but we get to be victimized over and over and over again, trying to keep him there.
I wouldn't be surprised if he has a TV in his cell.
Yeah, right. On our dime.
Yeah.
So we have about 4 minutes left to this particular episode. Again, this is I didn't want to name it with his name, but ultimately the series is going to be called Warren Forrest Murder Trial, and it's part one. We'll have a part two for sentencing, and we'll have some other experts on, as well as the ladies if they'd like to come back. But I'd like to give you each a minute to last thoughts until we're on again. What you hope at sentencing, how you're feeling, and where we go from here. Star, why don't you go?
Okay. I hope when he gets sentenced that it's 36 years to life again, because I think that's the maximum they can give for that time period. And I wish he would show some remorse, you know? But, of course, he won't. But I hope he hears with the sentence loud and clear, he'll know that he did. I want that to be a loud and clear message. And I think it will be when he hears his sentence. He will lose all hope of ever getting out.
Do you have any last thoughts for Michael Morrison and Martha's family or Krista's family at this time, or any of the other victims that we're still in seek of answers for?
Yes, I hope that it gives them some sort of peace, that they will never have to listen to him again talking about how much he deserves to get out, because he's a changed person. So I hope him going down as a serial killer will give them some sort of comfort, too, because that was his big thing. Oh, I only killed one. No, you didn't. And now people will know who he really is. And I hope that Martha's family has peace now with this guilty verdict. And I know that we probably can never get him charged on all the others, but I hope they realize that he is a serial killer, that he is now a sentenced serial killer. And I hope that gives them some sort of peace and a feeling of justice, because it does for me. And I hope it does for them.
Well, thank you for being a star, because 50 years is a long time to keep up a fight, looking for answers and knowing that the media attention has helped quite a bit. And like we said in court, justice for Martha is a justice for all of you. So Norma, last thoughts?
I'm not sure what my last thoughts are. I don't have any expectation at sentencing for anything different than what his life is right now. We've already learned from the parole board they gave him 10 more years on his original sentence. So all I'm looking forward to now is a way to touch his humanity, if there ever was any in him, so that he will tell the truth. Just tell us the truth about all of your other victims.
Do you think you'll hear that?
That's what I'm hoping for. I doubt it. He hasn't changed in 50 years, but you have to keep hoping for that. It's something to hold on to. Go on with your life. I will go on with my life the way that I have the last 48 years, But always I'm going to be hoping that something, there is something that will unlock his soul enough to give us the information we want, to give Star the closure she needs, to give these other families, what's left of them, some little measure of peace about their own daughters, sisters, aunts, mothers.
Yep.
Yeah, the twins, Carol Valenzuela, the mother of the twins, it, you know, it destroyed their family. You know, and the girls had to grow up without their mother, twin girls.
You brought up her name. How does it make you both feel that it was brought up in court that despite her remains being found with Martha's, that they, I understand the principle of why they couldn't bring that in, but doesn't that say a lot that, you know, there was somebody else there with Martha, and that there may be more evidence in that entire area that leads to answers and justification for justice for all of the victims?
Yeah,
that was hard to hear, too.
Absolutely. But if you think about it, that was his method of operation. I was 169 feet away from Krista, and she'd only been there 6 days when he took me out there. That was his method. That's what he did. He went to the places he was familiar, that he had better expectations to not be caught. Exactly.
Right. And it was a prosecutorial decision by the prosecutor, and they knew that if they put both of them in and the jury couldn't believe it on the other one, which I don't know why they wouldn't, but then they lost all chance of getting a conviction for Martha.
Then they would lose him. That's right. They would lose him on both. So they didn't want to muddy the waters. This was about Martha because they knew with that DNA evidence, they were going to get a conviction.
Exactly. They can't argue with that. And they, if they had had DNA evidence for Carol, they would have charged him with both. But they didn't have that kind of evidence. They have evidence that they're not telling us, but it's not DNA, or they would have charged him with both.
Or they would have been able to charge him. Dr. Mathis, you know, over the years of doing this work that I've done for victims and children, et cetera, I've always been told by experts and such, there's no coincidences in crime. There is no coincidence that Carol's remains were discovered right around where Martha's remains were found. And you know, and like you just heard from Norma, she was only feet away. And so my question is, there's no coincidences in crime, right?
Exactly. And the fact that we know through, you know, statistics from the research that's done that serial killers get away with about 40% of their crimes. So we know there's serial killers. There's more victims and bodies out there that these individuals have hidden or are discovered, but there's not enough evidence to be able to tie them in. But it doesn't take a brain scientist to figure out if there's another body very close by that is probably and likely one of his victims. So, you know, there is no coincidence. There is no, oh, it just happened to be here. Well, who put it here? When there's all these other victims here, who put that one here? You know, kind of thing. So some of the common sense that we have as individuals looking into these cases is common sense for law enforcement as well, but they have to go with evidence, you know, proof of evidence and that kind of thing. And so sometimes as badly as they want to provide justice, they can't. Their hands are tied too because of the way things are set up in our society. But I want to end with just saying to Star and Norma, cannot tell you the courage and the strength that the two of you have to face this monster, to be a part of the process of getting him convicted again. My heart goes out to you, and my love goes out to you for having to go through all of this again for justice. There is no closure, but there is justice. And closure is defined by each person affected by this monster,
mm-hmm.
and how they come to terms with this.
Mm-hmm.
That is their closure. So I mm-hmm. just want to tell you both, you're amazing, amazing. And I thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you for having us. Very much. And I second
any last
that,
thoughts?
Norma, on you.
Norma, any
can
last
you hear
thoughts?
Me?
I agree. I don't think there can ever be real closure, but there can be peace. You can finally
yeah.
be at peace with it. And that's what I'm hoping for whoever is left.
Exactly.
And I'm hoping for the same
exactly.
for both of you as well, because I know you've
thank
been
you.
Doing a lot of media interviews. You're speaking out. But I hope you're finding that the platform is now giving you the ability to be able to say what's on your mind, because your voices
absolutely.
Matter.
And
it
I will
does.
Tell you, if they bring him to trial again, I will be there every single time in whatever
me
capacity
too.
I'm allowed. I will be there. I don't care if it's re-traumatizing me. I don't care. It needs to be done, and I will do it every single time.
Me too.
Star, any last thoughts?
You know, I pray that he could tell the truth about Jamie, but I know he probably never will. And that part is hard, you know, but I've accepted that this is the closest thing I can get to justice for Jamie. And I've accepted that, and that I will probably go to my grave not knowing exactly where she is. But I am very grateful that he got convicted of Martha's murder, and they have her remains now, and they were able to cremate them. And they have peace in knowing that they finally know what happened to Martha as much as they could without him confessing.
Definitely. And like I said, we will be there at the sentencing on February 17th. We encourage anyone local to come out and support these survivors, victims' families, et cetera, to have a voice for justice, to make sure that this community knows we will stand up against violence. So, Kathy, as we end our episode two, going forward, you know, Star and Norma are just amongst many of the individuals we're going to have on this show for them to get their voices back, stand up, and say enough is enough. What do you have to say to anyone that is out there listening that may have been too scared to report, or if they saw something, they didn't say something, or if they are a victim of a crime that they need to be on a show like Spotlight for Justice, how can they stand up?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, if anything is going to change for you, if you are a victim of any kind of crime, nothing's going to change for you if you don't speak up about it, if you don't about it. if you don't go and prosecute whoever did it to you. There are lots of support systems available for victims and survivors out there to help you through the process. But I firmly believe that when our system is as broken as it is currently, that's one of the factors that keep people from coming forward, because they know they may be made out to be the one person that was the reason that crime happened to them. But again, if there is enough people that look at our systems that we have in place and say we need to change those, there are also groups that are willing and are already a part of trying to change those systems, and they can certainly join those groups as well. They can let NW Cave know what's going on. We have advocates. We've got therapists. We've got different people in place to help support them through the process. We also have collaborators, as you said at the beginning of the show. We don't do this alone. We have a lot of collaborators and people that we can refer people across the country to for the help and the assistance that they need. But as a survivor or a victim of a crime who's not going to talk about it, that if you don't talk about it, you're going to wear it. Your body's going to manifest it in some way. So I highly encourage you to find an 800 number for sexual assault, for domestic violence, for human trafficking. Call NWK. We can help refer out. Call any of the local coalitions and agencies in your community. Reach out to them. But the fact is, the main component in all of that is you have to reach out, because they don't know who you are and they can't help you unless you do turn around and reach out and say, I need some help.
And we do have a list of national partners and hotlines. If you go to www.nwcave.org/help, there's some resources there that you can go to their website. You can call their 800 hotline. There is help and hope, but like Dr. Mathis says, you must first make the call. And we hope that Spotlight for Justice continues to be a platform for those that would like to stand up against violence, fight for justice, or have us do it for you. So follow us again on any of our social media at NW Cave. And again, tune in. We will have more on this case as well as other cases coming up, and great speakers and guests. So we thank you. Thank you to our guests today, and thank you to everyone that is listening and sharing our podcast. We'll see you next time.